Today's parasha is called
Pekudei.
Yeah, Pekudei. And it's interesting, you know, when you're reading the Torah, you don't see Pekudei, do you? What do you see?
Pekudei.
Pekudei. So it sounds like a F rather than a P, even though when we read it, it says Pekudei. Well, now, why is that? If it says Elef Kudei, Elef Pekudei, these are the accountings of, then how come it says Pekudei rather than Pekudei? When the Torah word is Pekudei, but the portion name is Pekudei. Why is there a P instead of a F? What happened? Anybody got any ideas besides the grammarian of my son over there?
It's like pomegranate.
It's like pomegranate. He's got it. Pomegranate. A pomegranate. That's right. Exactly right. That's how pomegranate became pomegranate. Everybody can see that, right? Pomegranate.
I don't think so.
See, you can't go. And I don't want any plosives from you. No plosive. No explosion with your mouth. Just push the air out without exploding.
Pomegranate.
You got to say a P without a plosive. So what do you got?
Pomegranate.
See, you can't leave his lip alone, can you? You got to act like somebody's kissing you and you're not kissing. That's it. No? Yeah, right. Now say a P, only let's see it. Fuh. See what happens? Fuh. Make it a P. Fuh. 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 Right? Fuh. Right? Say put. Come on.
Put.
Oh, no,
put.
You can't close your lips.
Put. You want me to say foot?
Yeah, but then you close your lips. I don't want you to close your lips.
Foot.
See what happened? You did it. You did it. You finally pronounced a P like a fuh. And that's fami. Okay, that's Pekudei, because the reason is this. Avi, tell us.
Well, the pe is one of the Bagad Kafat letters, which means that it's has a dagash kal at the beginning of words. So if you see with the dagash pe as opposed to fe, dagash being the dot in the middle of it.
So it's got an easy dot.
Then at the beginning of a word, it has to always be a pay. And that's just a grammatical rule. It's for the same reason at the end of the word, it would always have to be a fey, a fey sofit. You just notice all this bagad kafa letters, like chaf sofit also can't be chaf sofit at the end, other than a rare exception. Or fey, or even a tav, sometimes that is a dagash in it, and not at the end of a word though, but. In this case, this is also another exception in a weird way, because we have Ele Pekudei, and the way Ele ends on an open syllable, so the rules get kind of picky at times, I guess, or very specific, but following an open syllable, you would have a F sound like at the end of a syllable, so really, it's like saying Elef Pekudei. It's like almost it's moving right into it. So they treat it as if it's really not the beginning of a word. It's kind of like continuing after an open syllable.
Yeah. See, it ends with a hey?
Yeah. But that will, yeah.
But in modern grammar, you wouldn't really do that anyway. You would say it's one word, and so it starts with a pe.
So because it ended with a hey, the previous letter.
And you leave with a pe?
Then you can't start with a pe anymore. The ending with the H is soft. They're going to open the thing up, so the kal, the dagesh, goes away. So the P goes to an F, just because it ends with a hey. If it ended with a yod, it would also happen. If it ended with a hyena, it would happen.
It's just a vowel. If it ends with a vowel sound as opposed to a closing.
Okay.
If it ended with any consonant, it would be closed off at the end of the word and have to start a new word.
Right.
It's harder to say Pekudei by itself, so you wouldn't say it by itself. You would say Pekudei.
So the Torah, at one time, all the letters were together. And there were no vowels. So Ele followed right into Pekudei, and you wouldn't even know that Ele was going to be the end of a word, and Pekudei would be the beginning of the next word. So you can see what would happen. Ele, then you're not going to end Elep, Elef, you know, Pekudei. So.
Can I ask a question?
Why not?
In the old Masoretic text,
yes.
The Hebrew, as far back as recorded we can go,
mm-hmm.
Do the Hebrew words run into one another, or is there a space between the Hebrew words?
Well, if you go back to Qumran, would be an example.
Yeah.
Then you'd just be solid, right?
So there's no spacing.
No spaces.
So you don't know when one word ends and another begins.
Right. Masoretes introduced that maybe 7th, 8th century. 8th. So that's what happened.
That was pretty challenging.
Yeah, well, that's right.
Where is that Dead Sea Scroll series? Is it sitting here somewhere?
Well, the ones that we just sent for the encyclopedia?
No,
the Temple Scroll?
It's like a 2-3 volume thing. It's got samples.
Right.
Maybe you can see.
Well,
I'll look.
Right. We'll let Pat look around for the Temple Scroll. Who's around here?
Is it a book?
Yeah,
three books.
What color?
Beige.
I don't know. It used to be very dusty on the top.
Beige and big. Big books. Big books.
Okay.
But. Mm-hmm. Now we're on the last book of the Torah, right?
Right, yeah.
No, last book of Exodus.
Oh, I'm sorry. The last portion of a book, right?
Of Exodus.
Last portion of the book Shemot.
Right.
And when it ends, what do we wind up saying? Let us be strong.
And that means,
let us be strong. Let us be strong and
strengthen one another. Just don't ask me to sing it.
Nope. Now, our new covenant portion, is drawn from Hebrews 8, and we took verses 1-13, and we're looking at. The new covenant against what God had done when he filled the tabernacle. When he filled the tabernacle with his glory, this came right at the conclusion of the book of Exodus and right in this portion, Pekudei. In Pekudei, Moses gives a complete accounting. We drive the last nail into the ground. We finish building the tabernacle, and God immediately, because we did it faithfully and we did it exactly, one of the most incredible phrases appears again and again and again in this portion, and with the pickup of speed is in the book of Exodus. Kol asher tziva Adonai, according to Kol, according to all the commands that God commanded Moses, according to all that God commanded Moses. Kol asher tziva Adonai et Moshe. So there's your et Moshe. So when God is making this command. We're suddenly manifesting perfect obedience, and we do it. And there was like a 7-stage process in putting this tabernacle together. And at the very end, it's like, "Hello, you're about to enter, perfect rest, Shabbat, and everything else." So, the tabernacle is being completed. It's a new creation. New creation is being completed, and boom! What happens?
The Lord comes.
The glory of the Lord fills the tabernacle so much that Moses can't get in to minister. You can't get any work done at all in the place because there's glory everywhere and Avodah disappears. Moses, do some Avodah. No. I thought everything was, Avodah, Talviim, V'yad Itamar. No more Avodah because he couldn't get in. You see this? There's the tag from the beginning of the portion. We're doing the service of the tabernacle, but when we actually finish the thing according to the perfect instruction of God, he fills it with his glorious presence, and nobody can do anything. Moses can't get in there and minister. The place is just filled with glory. Now, these are important things because you can spend, a nation had spent its entire life up to that point getting to that place. And finally, it got there in perfect unity. Yeshua comes and he prays for unity. I pray they might be one that the world would know. Well, here we're one, and boom, the world knows. Glory hits, wham, power. So where's the power from God? Well, the answer is, where's the obedience and the unity of the people of God? Well, what else Caesar said to them? Well, that's right. But if you got that, you'd see the glory of God. You'd see power and work. So you have to do your little bit, and meanwhile, everybody else is out of sync. And meanwhile, you're out of sync. But you do your little bit, you're moving somewhere, and the nation does its little bit, it gets to a closure point, something big, important. Now, your life is that way. You've got a whole life coming together. When that whole life comes together at a certain time, glory, important things, major things, God's going to play peekaboo. He's going to show a serendipitous face. He's going to come out. You're going to have major things happen. Well, this doesn't happen to everybody all that often. It happens once in a rare moment. Well, when does it happen then? Usually in a very ordered moment, in my opinion. I'm talking about you having your personal experience where it's really real for you. God's going to show his face at a time when he picks. When Abraham was in the middle of the circumcision the third day, he's in the worst pain in life and he's being tested on hospitality. But he's good for it. So he hops up and jumps around. And guess what? He's going to become the father of a mass of nations. And right there, God's going to say, okay, we're good for you. Sarah's good for a kid next year exactly this time. Start counting. 1 year. Now, he got 3 months to get his act together, and then 9 months from now, bingo, he's going to have this kid. Yitzhak, it's going to be a laughing matter. And he'll be laughing for the rest of his life over that. Subject to the test, it just shows faith. But the point is, God shows up. In the book of Hebrews, they say he shows up and he entertains. We've entertained angels unaware. It happens when we're just going about being our regular holy souls. Not our regular
ordinary selves.
Our regular ordinary selves, but in a mundane manner. But mundane is holy because we're set apart for God, and what we're doing is something that glorifies him. And when you're doing something that glorifies him, well, that's a holy moment. In a real holy moment, God's going to pick a holy moment to show up. What does holy mean? It's set apart for God. He's going to show up when there's a fruit of that going on. So that doesn't mean he's going to come on Saturday. And it doesn't mean, you know, you got to be keeping Shabbat to see him. What it means is that the holy edge in your life, which may be on Shabbat, what it means is the way you're living your life, day in and day out, and what you do for your whole life, that's what's going to accumulate. All these little insignificant nothingness are going to accumulate until you're at a place where you're really ready for face-to-face with God. I mean, what happened if you were pure in heart today? Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. So, gee, why don't you just go out and be pure in heart and take care of that? I mean, what's your problem? You understand what I'm getting at here?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what it is to fill the place with glory. Now, the new covenant, we get these promises. They're considered newer and better promises. Newer and better promises. And there are a whole series of things. Maybe we can... people that have scriptures, open up Hebrews, and I'm going to call for a couple of scriptures, because I want to look at what the new covenant is and sort of set a background here for Hebrews 8. And then after that, I want to jump to Matthew, and I want to talk about how Jesus was interacting with Caiaphas, Aramaic name Kepha, his Greek name Petro. Petros is the same. It means rock. And Peter, one time, he's going to have a divine revelation, and then he's going to turn around right after having a divine revelation, and Jesus is going to say to him, blessed are you, you know, because flesh and blood is not revealed to you, but the Father who's in heaven. What did he just say? And what did he just say?
That he was the Son of the...
You're the Messiah, the Son of the living God. It's like Son of God, Messiah. You know, he's putting together a few things here. And Yeshua, you know, he's blown by this. He says, well, you didn't get that on your own. You didn't just figure that out because you're looking at me right now. You got inspired. And that inspiration came from God the Father, who dropped that into your head through the Holy Spirit. That's what just happened. Flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you. It came spiritual, from godly channel. Ruach HaKodesh revealed this to you. And it came from God the Father. All right. And then 1 minute later, a couple of verses later in the scripture, Yeshua's going to be looking at Peter and say, what did you just say? I shouldn't suffer for the world. Get behind me, Satan. I mean, what happened here? What kind of a turnaround is this? You go from divine revelation to being called Satan overnight by the Messiah. Isn't that wonderful? I mean, do you see how fast you can get knocked off your...
God horse.
Yeah, I was going to... leave it blank, but you fill it in. And it's an important lesson to remember. The highs and the lows often come together. I would say they mostly come together. So you have a high point, and then Spike give you a low point. They don't come together.
Yeah.
Bunch of hot air comes together, right? So anyway, you got an interesting situation that plays out here, then, with the highs and lows. And I want to alert you to this in life. I want to tell you that they're often smacked together. So when you're standing there, if you're in a low place, get ready. Maybe there's exaltation around the corner. And if you're in a high place, it's like, you got a choice. You can get humble in a hurry, or you're going to be humbled in a hurry.
But usually, when you're in a low place, if you have God at all in your heart, that's when you pray to God to help you to come to the rescue.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, it is amazing. You know, and usually, that's when you meet him.
See, so believers, you know, they got a sanguine attitude about the idea that, you know, if they're not beat up, they don't come to God very much. Right. You got to be beat up to really come to God.
Really beat up.
Why don't you wake up every morning and say, you know, I got a choice here. I can get beat up or I can really say the Shema.
Well,
why don't you say that every morning? I can get really beat up or I can really say the Shema. Because, you know, if I don't really say the Shema, probably I'm going to get beat up and then I'll really say the Shema. So why don't I, like, get a clue here? Why do I have to keep going through this drama here? Maybe I can keep from getting beat up by meditating on having a humble approach to God right up front in the morning.
Yeah.
Now, I already told you about how we go running off, whoring with our eyes, if we're men. And for women, we grab everything and, you know, get a hold of it, put it in its place. Boom. Yeah, I know. Never heard of that. So when we have all this thing going on, it's like maybe we could get a clue and say to ourselves, maybe there's a better way to approach this. Like maybe I can be a little smarter than I normally am. My normal animal self is, I don't have to worry about humility because, you know, it's a drag, right? I don't have to worry about it. And then we get humbled and then we don't worry about it either. We just reap the fruits of it. But why do you have to wait to get beat up? I mean, look at it from God's position for a minute. God's going, oh, here comes Marcel again. Oh, look at him. He's on his high horse again. Oh, he's going to blow this whole day off. Well, knock him off the horse. Boom! Marcel hits the concrete. He says, man, I needed that. Now, what happened? What was this all about? You had to be a believer to say, I needed that. If you're not a believer, you'd say, another cursed day, right?
Well, mm-hmm. You'd curse it. Yeah.
You'd curse it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But you're a believer, you say, I needed that. Yeah, now, you understand? Yeah. If you're smart enough to say, I needed that, why don't you get ahead of the curve and, like,
do it up front.
Do it before you need it. Yeah. Why don't you do it before you need it? I'm just saying, in the morning, try it.
Yeah.
Okay? And think to yourself, if I don't have a real, you know, humble time with God for a minute, maybe I'm really asking for it today, you know? And if I don't get it today, maybe I'm really asking for it worse next week, you know, and so on. It's like, let's get ahead of the curve. Hebrews 8, let's see. Who has Hebrews? I went to chapter 7.
Hebrews 7?
Yeah, because I'm painting some context here. Somebody else can turn to Hebrews 1. And who can read Hebrews 1, verses 1 to 3?
Now?
Yeah, go ahead, Dave.
God, after he spoke long ago to the fathers and the prophets in many portions and in many ways, in these last days has spoken to us in his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, through whom also he made the world. And he is the radiance of his glory and the exact representation of his nature, and upholds all things by the word of his powers. When he had made purification of sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high.
Now, what's the title of this book? Peros Hebreos, which is really for the Hebrews. But you know, this was a letter, and it didn't say for the Hebrews on the letter. That's made up. So in your mind, if you're going to think about this, you've got to say somebody added that, an editor, later. And the guy that wrote it didn't put that in there. So
we don't know who wrote it.
No, we don't know who wrote it. We don't even know who wrote the book.
Mm-mm.
But the guy that wrote the book is different than the guy that wrote the title to the book. So this is composite there. Composite authorship there, if you're going to look at it that way. It's an editorial move. The guy wrote Pros, the Hebraeus. But that's not in the letter. That's later. So when we're, you know, to read the Torah, we strip these chapters off and we look at it for ourselves. You got to take according to the Hebrews or for the Hebrews, throw it out. Decide that some guy that came later told you that's what this is. Maybe it's not written to the Hebrews at all. Okay? Maybe it's written to suffering congregation that had Jews and Gentiles in it that's getting oppressed by the Roman Empire. And they're being told a few things in this letter. And basically, they're being told, you know, this persecution that you're going through, buck up. You know, you're doing fine. It's tough out there. Hang in there. Because you got something better than a patron in Roman society. And in fact, you got something better than the Jews that aren't believers as far as patrons. You got direct access to the big man, to the big patron, through the broker, Yeshua. He brokered a relationship to the big man. And the Jews don't know that. Only the believing Jews know that. They're the Messianics. And that's why you got a better covenant. And the Romans, I know you guys, you know, got relationships there where we got a society and you guys are have-nots, a lot of you. And you need patrons and benefactors because you don't have what you need to eat. You don't. I know that. But some of these guys are trying to get you to go to the temple and visit Zeus or Jupiter now because the Greeks really won. Even though the Romans conquered them, the Greeks passed the gods on to the Romans, and Roman mythology is Greek mythology. And the Greeks conquered at the level of culture, and now these guys are trying to enculturate you. And in fact, they're trying to tell you that you're marginalized. And the Jews, by the way, they're not marginalized, so it's kind of tempting, you know, for you to be Jewish right now, rather than Messianic Jewish or Christian, whatever you want to call it. And really, we're going to call it Christian now, Hebrews. We're writing to the Hebrews to say, you know, don't leave Jesus. Don't leave Yeshua, because he opened up the way to the big man. And you don't want to go there, giving back that, busting up that, just to get fed or just to get accepted. And so you've got to despise the shame that the culture is laying on you, the marginalization. You feel like you're insignificant, nothing, and they're out to marginalize you. And it is. It's the big guys and the big system. They want to shame you into embracing their ethics. And you're outies over this, both from the Jews, in their viewpoint, and from the Greco-Romans. But don't fall for it, guys. You got the real patron, and you can eat at a table that the Jews can't get to. And don't give it up. And I know they're persecuting you, and I know you need to eat, but buck up. You get it? This is tough stuff. Look at Hebrews 7, though, read verse 22.
Because of this oath, Jesus has become the guarantee of a better covenant.
So there's an oath. Now, was there an oath originally? See, when the Torah was given, was there an oath? See, the Abraham, he talked with God, but it was at the Akedah that there was an oath. Prior to the Akedah, until God, Abraham offered up Isaac as his only son, God was saying, I'm going to give you this land, you're going to have a lot of people, we're going to call it Abraham, we're going to give you the land of promise, and you're going to be fruitful, multiply, and you're going to have the father of many nations, and you're going to have this son, and he's going to have tribes, and you're going to have father of many families, and all this. And right here in this land, everything you tend to walk on, it's going to be yours. Meanwhile, he's a Canaanite, he's out there, he's got nothing. Finally, when he offers up Isaac, this is Genesis 22, God says, okay, I swear an oath now. He'll inherit the gates of his enemies, because Asher, Ekev Asher Shamata Bekoni, on account of that you listened to my voice, and offered your son, your only son Isaac, even though Ishmael's over there watching at the Akedah, you know, and according to tradition, along with the other heir to be his senior steward, Eliezer. So you got the senior steward and the son watching Abraham follow God's direction to offer up Isaac as a olah. Very powerful, right? That's when God swears an oath. The angel of the Lord shows up and says, I swear an oath. On account of you did this, this only thing for me, and you bet the ranch, then that's it. Isaac, your son, your only son, seed of the promise, won't inherit the gates of his enemies. And I like to say after that, if you're an anti-Semite, look out, because you're up against an oath now. that you'll chase them away, but they'll still be around, and God's going to come after you later because he's got an oath to Abraham that they're going to inherit you. So you don't want to be on that side of the equation. Your eternal life will be in this world. It'll be temporary, and at some point you'll be inherited. And, you know, Esau's land, it's tough to find it now. But Israel, you can find. Things like that happen. So you got to watch out. God's patient. Thousands of years go by, but then things happen. When they happen, it's one-way street, man. So this is very important. Now, look at Hebrews 8, verse 6. What does that say?
But now he has obtained a more excellent ministry, inasmuch as he is also mediator of a better covenant, which was established on better promises.
Better covenant, better promises, and a mediator.
Right.
And the idea, again, in a Roman society, this is a broker. He's bringing together the parties. The broker takes the benefactor, or the patron, and takes the have-not guy, and he puts them together. Now, when we're, you know, out of communion with God, and we got no access, this is a problem, right? But what's happening in the book of Hebrews, they had this original idea floating around there, the Greeks, Plato. What was Plato's God? What was heaven? You know what heaven was?
Pantheon.
There was Pantheon, but there's something else too going on. Archetypal reality. What is heaven? What's an archetype?
Well, Earth is an archetype of heaven.
No. This heaven's archetype.
Everything outside of the cave was heaven.
Everything outside the cave was
right.
Heaven. But how do you get there, you see?
Just get out the exit.
Flight from Laputa. You see this thinking here?
Yeah,
the only way to get into heaven was through
stages of mental
intellectual ascension. So it's an ideal land that you can't get into. It's an ideal land that's inaccessible. It's like it's up there in the archetypal realities that don't change. And the real thing is this idea. What happened to your idea? You can't get into your idea. You see, you got an idea, it came out of your head, it's up there. The idea is the real thing. Now see, if you turn around and say, I got an idea for a car, and then you go build a car, that car's not real, the idea was. And that car's not perfect, it falls apart, but that car keeps going. The car that you think of in heaven, it doesn't rust, it runs on no gas, it self-cleans, this is a car. But down here, what you try to approximate it with, the sucker rusts, it runs out of gas, it gets rained on, the tires blow. I mean, it's a drag. So the archetypal reality, that's the idea. And if you could drive that car, you'd be in Fat City, but you can't get there. Well, that's what's going on in the Plato thing. Now, Hebrew guy, Hebrews, according to the Hebrews, then, the author of this letter, that has no title, it's not called Hebrews in the letter, comes in and he says, okay, what's the Jewish cosmology? The Jewish cosmology, we got heaven, Yeshua's the broker, and you're in. Boom. He's got access to heaven. Boom. He's in. He drafts a Jewish cosmology over Plato, and suddenly you can get into heaven for Yeshua. And you got a high priest up there, and when you die, and he's the guy that opens the way into the real heaven, into the real temple. It's like you're going to become real, and you're going to get in. You're going to turn into, Plato would say, what? You're going to turn into an idea? You're going to die and then go away as an idea? I'd say, well, yeah, that's the real thing, you see. The idea is your glorified body. And guess what? Your glorified body doesn't rust. It doesn't even blow gas. You know what I mean? I mean, the dog is going to live forever in heaven without having to eat, let alone.
Sure.
So, here you've got the author of Hebrews talking in 8:6, so we got these better promises into a better way, and the mediator is the broker. He's figured out a way to bring together this out of reach heaven and this God the Father who you look on and you die, and you can behold the glory of God and just go up and do it because you're this living glorified body of an idea that just got in because you got a high priest that opened it up. So now in Hebrews. I mean, in Pukude, what do we got? We got the real tabernacle being built Except Hebrews is saying, well, that was an archetype. That's a shadow of the thing that the reality was in heaven. So, okay, it was a shadow. And then what happened? It got filled with the glory of God. Yeah. And then nobody could go in there, right? Well, that was a real idea that happened down here, wasn't it? And when Moses was there, what do you mean? Nobody can go in there. You try going in there. You burn up like a crisp. I mean, the sun's in there or something. I don't know what's going on. Nobody can go near that place. See? Well, all of a sudden, Messiah goes up to the real one. High priest walks in. Hello. And you got access. And he's telling the people that are getting persecuted, listen, you know, nobody's got this. The Jews, they got to sit on the altar. They got to eat down here. They can't eat at the table on the heaven. They can't get up there and sit down. They got no invitation. They got no way to get in. You got it. You're going to trade that away for what? A little glory down here? Like the patron smiles at you and you're not going to be shamed and you're not going to be thrown out and you're not, you know, you're going to give that up? You're going to give that idea up? It's not an idea. It's a promise. It's a reality. You get there on faith. It's real. It's the archetypal reality. You're going to go for the shadow. You're going to live in the body that's going to perish. You're going to try to, you know, have 40 years of glory down here and then gone. And you want that against this, getting into this thing here? What are you, nuts? Hebrews 9:23. Somebody read.
That is why the sacred tent down here on earth and everything in it, all copied from things in heaven, all had to be made pure by Moses in this way, by being sprinkled with the blood of animals. But the real things in heaven, of which these down here are copies, were made pure with far more precious offerings.
So what was the offering that made pure the reality, the real archetype one in heaven?
Yeshua.
The blood of Yeshua, the life of Yeshua, because the life's in the blood. And the blood had a cleansing effect. And if it cleanses down here, all the more so up there. And does somebody read Hebrews 13, verse 10?
We have an altar from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat.
We have an altar that the priests, that the Kohanim can't get to. We know in the tabernacle, it was temple showbread, and you sit in a holy place and eat. There were only certain kind of offerings, communal offering. The big ones, the ones that really mattered for everybody, they would eat that in the presence of God. It was a top piece of, you know, top sacrifice. I mean, you got to take it to that restaurant, you know, you're going to eat better than anybody. I mean, even a filet mignon, they just take the ghee out, and then they give you the filet. See? Somebody take that ghee out for you, see? You would sit down there, and you'd eat filet mignon that somebody picked the ghee out on. Because it was okay as long as you didn't eat the ghee. But, you know, the priesthood, they could get the ghee out. They could have some guy sit there, take the ghee out all day. And after he got the whole ghee out, so they were sure there's nothing in there, give it to you. And you can eat it. Say, oh, this tastes fine, it's good. I like filet mignon. Everybody's eating well in the priesthood. And they're saying, well, wait a minute, we can eat at a table that makes those guys look like pikers. We can eat the real priesthood too. In the real temple, up there. Are you going to pass up that banquet ticket? You don't want to die and, you know, find out? You don't want to live, you know, in Yeshua and then find out? You want to just, you know, say, well, that's later and who cares? And later never comes because, you know, I'm going to die first. Is that what you're going to do? Well, that's what he's saying. Watch out. Now, to go along here, we get to Hebrews 8, and they're going to quote the New Covenant, right? In verses 8 through 12. Hebrews 8, 8 to 12, quotes Jeremiah 31, 31 through 34. Now, Jeremiah is drawn from the Septuagint, and the guy that's writing Hebrews is reading a Greek document, and he's reading the Septuagint. And it's a little variation even on the Septuagint, but that's what he's quoting. He's not quoting from the Masoretic text of Jeremiah 31 from the Hebrew. It's Greek to Greek, and you can look at it, and it's very clear. So somebody read verses 8 through 12 in Hebrews 8.
Hebrews
because finding fault with them, he says, "Behold, the days are coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah."
Well, stop for a moment. When you make a new covenant with the house of Israel or the house of Judah.
Right.
Now, in Walk, page 205, I wrote, the new covenant is still made with the house of Israel, not the church. And I was saying that to say, it doesn't say that this is the house of the Gentiles or that this is how. But boy, I really blew somebody's mind because they wrote back and they said, "Well, what do you mean the new covenant is with the church?" You know, it's like, well, that's what I want.
You only got one letter like that?
Just one. The person was livid, I can tell you. And I thought, yeah, you know, I can't believe that. You know, I was so excited when I, you know, when it dawned on me that in Jeremiah, when he was writing this, that we already had been in exile and the house of Israel was already, like, gone as far as the 12 tribes. You were down to two or whatever. The 10 had disappeared. And so I was saying, if they already disappeared, and this guy's in exile already talking about whether the next guys are going to disappear, and it's down to Judah, why isn't he saying this is the covenant I'll make with the house of Judah and with the house of Noah or something? You know what I mean? Something that would, you know, include everybody. Why is he still the same old categories for the same old crowd? You know, while all this is the new, the brand new, the renewed new, the new moon, the new, whatever it is, what is it?
They haven't given up on the Jews.
They haven't given up. Right, he's not going to give up on the Jews because the whole thing won't be complete unless he gets the whole thing. And that's going to include the Jews even if they don't like it, right?
That's right.
Okay, so keep going.
"Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day when I took them by the hand to lead them out of the land of Egypt."
A lot of people read that and they say, well, isn't this clear then that, you know, that a covenant is gone or... You know, I'm going to make you a real covenant rather than this wigged-out covenant that doesn't work, that's no good. You see? We get from that because of the comparison. I'm going to make this covenant now, and it's not going to be like that one there. Yeah, I'm going to give you...
a new and improved.
Pecan pie instead of arsenic poison. See? That's what people like to read into this. Like, you know, Torah's arsenic poison. You know, the comparison there is almost like, I'm going to give you something good now in place of that old bad thing that, you know, didn't work.
That I gave you.
Yeah, that I gave you.
Eyes of God. And
yeah.
You know, that knew the future.
And that's part of what kills me.
I know.
Right? Because if I'm standing there saying, well, the Jews were conned today, who's going to get conned 2,000 years from now? The new us.
That's right.
Hey, you know, this is the song that never ends, because it goes on and on, my friends. Some people, you know that song?
Oh, you bet.
It doesn't make for casual reading, does it?
No.
Casual understanding.
No, you know.
It has to be a
and everybody's study. So glad they're getting into the new, improved, you know, thing. It still works today in advertising, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
The new, improved Crisco.
Mm-hmm.
It kills you just as fast as the old improved Crisco. It's got good smell this time.
And it's warranted.
It's warranted.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you come back 20 years from now, we're going to have a new improved Crisco that's much better than this.
Yeah.
But you should live so long. Don't worry. You won't see it.
My wife's Russian-English dictionary is the new one.
The new one, yeah.
She's had as long as I've known her.
Everybody loves new. Brand new.
Yeah.
All right. So keep going, Marcel. You're doing great here.
Continue?
Yeah, verse 10
okay,
or something?
You want me to continue where I stopped?
Eat big, keep going.
Well, you stopped me at Egypt.
Yeah, keep going. That's
okay.
Right.
"Because they did not continue in my covenant, and I disregarded them, says the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make, that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says the Lord. I will put my laws in their mind and write them on their hearts. And I will be their God, and they shall be my people."
Now, wait a minute. I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Well, there's something brand new, isn't it?
No.
No? When's the last time we heard that one?
In Exodus.
Exodus 6,
well,
verse
7. Actually,
Exodus 20.
Exodus 6, verse 7. And every Jew sin at Passover, you say, what's the fourth cup? And they'll say, it's this cup that's the I will be your God.
They shall be my people.
You'll be your people cup, right?
Right.
So here we go. And meanwhile, somehow we must not have got that cup yet. In fact, we, you know, still waiting for the Messiah to come and drink that.
Well, this is a more personal covenant.
Here
the other one was the covenant of the laws.
Yeah.
This is, we'll put them on their heart, which is different.
Right. It's going to be different because it'll be put on their hearts. Whose hearts?
people part?
Israel.
Which people?
The believers.
Israel's.
Which believers?
Israel.
Israel. The believers of the house
of Israel.
Of Israel. And the house
of Judah.
And it's a tall order because where is the house of Israel when Jeremiah is writing? The students are going, oh, we ate those guys about 150 years ago. Mm-hmm. Every one of them is a great-grandfather Syrian now. You know, they got Assyrian names, they disappeared, they don't have temple here anymore. We never heard of those guys. But if you look around the world, they're everywhere, right? You got Ephraimite theology out there, and everybody's the 10 lost tribes. They're coming from everywhere, right? And you ask them, and they know it, right? And I can't wait for the DNA testing.
I got to tell you something. I got to interject.
Yeah.
I mean, this has been on my heart all week.
Yeah.
Isaiah 19:23-25. You got to read that. Well, 16-25.
Okay.
Dynamite.
Okay.
You know,
highway.
You know what that is?
Going down the highway.
The highway from Syria to Egypt.
Right.
With Israel and a path.
Yeah. You can't
obedient to God.
Didn't you know it's Interstate 1, Interstate 666? It's an interstate. It's on the global plan.
Oh, believe me.
Have you read the Peace in Israel movement? And they've got the government program there.
But I got to tell you something.
That's Highway 666.
The only problem with that section is it says in that day, which means at the back end of everything, at the back end of the trip.
It's always at the end.
Yeah. No. Yeah. That Isaiah 19.
Don't worry, Marcel. If you survive, you'll see it. Right? Okay. Well, keep going now.
Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Okay, I'm still going.
Yeah, you're doing great on this.
Okay.
We're in the middle of the new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah.
Right, and I will be their God and they shall be
their already people. Figured out it's for the Gentiles and it's written on everybody's heart and it's got nothing to do with the house of Israel or the house of Judah and it's got nothing to do with I will be your God and you'll be my people. It's got to do with an individual salvation experience for anybody that right now appropriates Yeshua as Messiah. We already figured all that out, right? Keep going.
Okay, 1:11. None of them shall teach his neighbor and none his brother, saying, know the Lord, for all shall know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them.
Hold on. Now, has that happened?
Not yet.
It hasn't happened. So this thing that guy wrote about 2,000 years ago,
right?
That's like now I'm doing this. It's the day is drawn near for this now.
A great revival.
This is it. Yeah. And we've been waiting 2,000 more years for this. After 1,500 years when we had the last come on with Exodus 6, verse 7, which is the I will be your people thing. And all those guys got fed to the lions, so we're reading that. And this Hebrews here, it's being written. The more guys that are getting tortured by the Greco-Romans, Ignatius right now of Antioch is on his way. They're going to the prison, and they're saying, yay, you're the greatest martyr. We with you 100% here, the picnic basket for you in the prison. And then they take him up to Rome. Got him. And this is the background of what's going on right here. See? And meanwhile, you know, we're still living here in America where we're free. But they were living with the new covenant in Hebrews 8:8-12 in Antioch. Ignatius is getting. And this guy's writing this letter saying, listen, guys, you know, hang in there. You're doing fine. Don't forsake the faith. Keep going. This is good. The new covenant.
Okay. For I will be merciful to their unrighteousness, and their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more.
Okay. Well, it's all future, huh?
Not yet.
It's not yet. So, we got to wait for this. Meanwhile, we're waiting for it. But it's there. Okay? And you might as well read verse 13 while you're at it.
In that, he says, a new covenant. He has made the first obsolete. Now, what is...
Wait. Now, it's true your translation says obsolete.
Well, right? Yeah, but it probably means something else.
Right, it's a perfect passive participle that basically means it's passing away.
Okay,
so it's in the process of passing away. It's just like this thing's taken 2,000 years to come in. That one's taken, you know, a couple thousand years to go out. I mean, you get these kind of time horizons playing out here. It's important to realize
that. Yeah, but the next part explains that.
Yeah, okay.
It says, now what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
Yeah, that's right.
Is becoming obsolete.
Right, it's ready to vanish away.
Right.
Just like your body.
Right.
Just like this temple over here, which did vanish away pretty soon, and Yeshua said in that generation, by George, that did happen.
Yeah.
But then, you know, other guys were born with bodies that are passing away, and they're all getting piled up. Meanwhile, you know, we're still waiting for this day when it's written on our hearts. And some guys say, oh, no, it's written on my heart right now. See?
Well, for the believers it is.
So, okay, so believers say it's written on their heart.
Right.
Well, exactly what is written
on what's written on your heart?
No, but the thing
here's the phrase, all of them shall know. No, here's what I'm getting at with my question, though. Is it's easy to look in the English and say, I will write my law on their heart. In English, I'm left with the question, what law? What's he writing on our hearts?
The word.
What word?
This.
Well, I was looking it up in the Hebrew. It says Torah T. Torah T.
My instruction, my Torah.
Okay, well, what is this?
That's what he's saying.
What is this? This is God's instructions.
Well, yeah.
The whole thing?
The whole thing. From this end to this end.
When you read it in a Greco-Christian mindset, and I will write my laws on their hearts, for me, that has a different implication from Torah T, or my instructions, Torah.
Right.
One is a legalistic, archaic system that's outdated and focuses on killing goats and lambs, and the other is it's a lifestyle. It's more benevolent.
Okay, here's what I want to deal with now. This lifestyle. We're being conformed in the image of who?
Yeshua.
Now, I want to show you something. I want to show you real temptation that Yeshua went through. And I want to show you some details from his life. And I want to say that so far when we're looking at the New Covenant, you get to something like 1 Corinthians 1:23. It says, and the last enemy to be subjected, conquered, under his feet is going to be death. So in the meantime, he's up there in heaven. He's the broker sitting by the patron. He's up in heaven in the right hand of God, waiting for all the enemies to be subdued.
Well, up into a point.
And meanwhile, death is the last enemy. Okay? And meanwhile, what are we doing down here? We're paying taxes. And?
Business as usual.
Dying.
We're dying as usual. See? And I haven't seen anybody since Elijah, who got out of here.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
like you when you get a ticket on this planet, somebody says to you, I heard nobody's getting out of this place alive. And it's like, man, how did I draw that lottery ticket? What am I doing on this planet? I took a wrong turn. I mean, come on. I'm stuck in some place where nobody's getting out of here alive. So the last enemy, death, is like taking hostages all over the place. You say, well, it's a good thing that, Yeshua rose from the dead because, you're going to triumph over death. It's like, yeah, after
second
you die, usually,
death,
right?
A
second death. In the meantime, you're heading...
That, this distinction is not clear.
Ah.
There's two deaths.
Ah. Yeah, there's at least two deaths.
Well, two deaths that I'm aware of.
No, we die daily. I mean, there's all kinds of deaths. And I'm going to talk about that. Somebody read Matthew 4, verses 8 and 9. And while you're doing that, somebody else look up Matthew 3, 17. What I want to do is make some correspondences now in Yeshua's life. Because I want to say that if you're living Yeshua's life, you should expect to live his whole life. And not just the good part. But I want to talk about how dynamic this spiritual principle is. What's going on? And when I mean dynamic, I mean this is the story that plays out in everybody's life, starting with his life. In Matthew 4, 8 and 9, who can read?
Next, Satan took him to the peak of a very high mountain and showed him the nations of the world and all their glory. I'll give it all to you, he said, if you will only kneel and worship me.
So who's talking?
Satan.
Who's he talking to?
Yeshua.
What was he saying?
I will glorify
you
on earth.
And Yeshua, did he take the bait?
No.
Why not?
He quoted the word.
So why didn't he take the bait?
Because there was no inner response to the outward suggestion because of his divine nature.
Okay, and use the word of God to meet what really was a temptation.
Mm-hmm.
Now go to Matthew 3:17 and read this. This is when God is talking in the Sabbat cult during the baptism of Yeshua.
And behold, a voice out of the heaven said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.
So who said this? Voice out of heaven.
Father.
Called a bat call and called a father. Yeah, father's voice from heaven. Remember, he's up there in the idea land, and you know he's on. We can't get up there, and he's down here. He's talking, and the idea gets released on him. We got this idea. And what is this idea? This is my beloved son, in whom I am well pleased. Where's that coming from? Somebody look up Isaiah 42. And somebody else look up Psalm 2:7. Isaiah 42, verses 1. Start with that.
Behold my servant, whom I uphold, my elect one, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the Gentiles.
And you can go all the way to verse 4 if you like.
All the way to verse 4?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. He will not cry out, nor raise his voice, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break. A smoking flax he will not quench. He will bring forth justice for truth. He will not fail nor be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth. And the coastlands shall wait for his law.
And the coastlands shall wait for his law? Somebody turn to Matthew 12, verses 18 to 21. While you're doing that, I want somebody to read Psalm 2, verse 7.
I am obliged to proclaim that Adonai said to me, you are my son, I have begotten you this day.
The bat kol that we see quoted in Matthew 3:17 at the baptism of Jesus has pieces that are taken from Isaiah 42:1, which is the suffering servant, and from Psalm 2:7, which is the Son of God prophecies. And originally thought to mean David will have a son, and he'll have a son, and there'll always be a son of David sitting on the throne. And they didn't necessarily think it was divine, but here we got the bat kol saying, this is my son. So suddenly there's revelation going on. Son of God is more than just the son of David. Now Matthew 12, 18 to 21. One of the things Messiah was supposed to do was to get all the nations to trust in the Lord. That's one of the hallmarks of Messiah's ministry. So read Matthew 12, 18 to 21.
Here is my servant whom I have chosen, the one I love and whom I delight. I will put my spirit on him, and he will proclaim justice to the nations. He will not quarrel or cry out. No one will hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not snuff out, till he leads justice to victory. In his name the nations will put their hope.
In his name the nations what?
Will put their hope.
And what's that earlier part on justice?
He will proclaim justice to the nations.
How do you like that? The nations will cry out. Nations will have a... It's going to have an impact on nations. Now, the nations are to trust. Now, if you continue in Matthew 4, you can look at like verses 3 and 6. This comes after the baptism of Yeshua, after mikvah of Yeshua, and after the bat kol has made this comment. And what does 4, verse 3 and verse 6 say? Matthew 4, 3
and
6.
And the tempter came and said to him, if you are the Son of God, command that these stones become bread. In verse 6, and said to him, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written, he will command his angels concerning you, and on their hands they will bear you up, so that you will not strike your foot against the stone.
What does the tempter call him?
Son of God.
And then he says, don't worry, you know, angels take care of you. Well, that's more than just King David's kid, right? If David took a dive off the Temple Mount, I mean, you know, he'd have a headache, right? Big headache. So, the bat kol is talking about merging together suffering servant with David as Messiah and the Son of God. You got the suffering servant mixed in with Son of David and with Son of God. Right up front in the baptism, right in the mikvah. And then Satan is coming and saying, here's a way out where you don't have to suffer. You don't have to be the suffering servant. And so what does Yeshua do? You know, I mean, what would you do if you got an easy way out?
Well, what he said to Peter.
Well, that's where we're going to go next. 16, Matthew 16, verse 23. You see, after Yeshua faces it with Satan, he's going to face it again right in his camp. And right after the moment that Peter has revelation.
Yeah.
This is what's really glaring.
So the tempter was looking for his in. And when he heard Peter get by Yeshua, he says, Now it's my moment. Now it's my moment.
Just that fast. So look at it. Matthew 16, read 13 to 17, and you'll see the setup. It's the exaltation of Peter, really. Matthew 16, verses 13 through 17.
When Yeshua came to the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do you say the Son of Man is?" They replied, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and still others Jeremiah or one of the prophets. But what about you?" he asked. "Who do you say I am?" Simon Peter answered him, "You are Yeshua, the Son of the living God." Yeshua replied, "Blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for this was not revealed to you by man, but by my Father in heaven."
And then he goes on in verse 18, and read that one, Avi.
"And I tell you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not overcome it."
Now here Abraham, you know, when he offered up his son Isaac, God says, "I swear an oath, he will inherit the gates of his enemies." Now Peter's being told what? The gates of hell?
Okay.
So the gates is the city. The city where the gates are is the power structure. That's where the Zakenim are going to sit. That's where the seat of government is going to be. That's going to be where the defense of the city is. That's where the power and the might and the walls come together in the city. And it's an important place and it's power at work. And when you see the gates of the city, you're saying the might of the city and everything associated with its glory. So Peter is then told, "I'm going to build on you." By who?
Yeshua.
And does Peter have an idea who's telling him this?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he just came up with it.
Well, but he spouted it, but did he really understand what he had just said?
Well, it's a very important moment, you see.
Yes.
It's important.
Yes.
So, like you say, you know, he's trying to grasp it, right?
Right.
I mean, that's a good way to puff up yourself at that moment, even if you can't help it, right? I mean, the Lord says, "I'm going to build a universe on you, Marcel, right now." And you're going, "I didn't know he was the Lord. What's he talking about? And build a universe on me."
See,
that's a moment, that a mind-expanding moment. I mean,
you'd have
to think you were, you know, smoking cigarettes.
These disciples lived with Yeshua for 3 years.
Yeah.
On and off, continuously.
Right.
And even to the very end, they didn't really understand who he was.
But at this particular moment, Peter has just come up with divine inspiration.
It went from here to here.
Marcel got a picture here. He's got somebody that's brain dead talking.
Well, I don't think he fully understood what he was saying.
So in verse 23, let's read verse 23.
Why would he say what he did about not being crucified? He didn't really understand the concept.
Well, in verse 18, Yeshua says, "You are Petros, and on this Petra, on this rock, I'm going to build the ecclesia."
Right.
Now, the ecclesia are the called out ones. And I'm going to try to get to what that means in today. Ecclesia, the called out ones. And I'm basically asking you to toy with the idea that you're being called up to the Jewish cosmology, the cosmology that's transforming the Platonic archetypal reality called heaven. That you're being called to some place that no one can get to, that you can't get to. And you're looking at it and you can't see it.
But you're not saying literally.
No. Well, I'm saying this is the book of Hebrews. This is what he's actually telling these guys when they're dealing with the Greco-Romans, who are saying, you know, you need a patron and a benefactor, or you can't eat around here. And he didn't want the Jews. And they're saying, well, we got Torah, and that's a way, and that'll get us there. And then he's saying, we got the way, and you guys are idiots if you're going to try to, you know, get benefactors in Judaism or in Greco-Roman world right now. And then it's like, you don't get it. But Marcel just pointed out this, and you can be looking at Messiah right in the face, and God can be talking right through you in the Holy Spirit, saying you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God, and it's your mouth moving and your brain dead to it while you're saying it. And this is the kind of reality, you know. You're,
I'll leave now.
Isn't it good, Marcel? I mean, it's painted graphically here. So Messiah turns to Peter and says, yep, you're Petros, and I'm going to build the ecclesia. He's going, wow, you know, the Catholics are going to say I'm the first pope. I can't believe it. I'm St. Peter already. I did it. I'm in charge of the Greco-Roman Empire. They're going to have to rename it the Roman Catholic Church because it's from Rome and it's over everything. Yeah, that's it. I'm going to be the first pope. Is the pope Catholic? Peter, that's me. I'm for everybody. So that's it. You got it. St. Peter.
Is kippa changed shape to one of those real pointy kippas?
You like that pointy kippa? Now, they did say he was going to suffer, but let's get to that. Verse 21, read it. Verse 21. This is how Messiah responds to Peter's, you know, great moment here. So let me read Matthew 16, verse 21.
From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day.
Now get this. Peter's just figured out that he's going to have the ecclesia built on him. Messiah turns around and says, yes, so I'm going to go and get killed, you know, and first I got to suffer. And then after that, things will be good, you know, really move forward. And the guy's going, just a minute now, you know, I didn't know you were the Messiah a minute ago, and now you're going to suffer and get killed. What is this, the gong show? I can't believe this. Peter's got to be a boom. So, okay, suffer, be killed, and then you're raised. Oh, okay, I get it. So Peter has a nice in-the-flesh response that's characterized by pure human compassion. He rebukes Yeshua. Now, you know how important compassion is. So here's Peter manifesting compassion after Jesus comes up with this idea saying, oh, you know, I got to go get killed. At first I got to suffer, then I got to get killed. And he's going, wait, but you're building the church on me. You can't do that. Besides, you know, you're the Messiah. I mean, you can't, you're taking over. You're going to become the Roman Empire. I mean, come on. So verse 22, Peter says,
Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, God forbid it, Lord. This shall never happen to you.
I mean, wouldn't you say that if somebody was saying to you, you know, I got to go suffer and then get killed?
That would be a human response.
See,
that would
be a human
response.
Not compassionate, though, right?
Not what?
Not compassionate. I mean, you know, if Donald Trump said it, you'd say, well, you deserve it. I mean, I want to know how compassionate you are, Marcel. I'll pick somebody else, a New York cab driver, somebody that tried to assassinate you yesterday, anybody. Somebody that, you know, you don't expect it. So verse 23, Peter's response is what?
No, Yeshua's response.
Yeah, Yeshua's response. Scandal on mui! What's this? What's he saying?
There's a scandal in that.
Get behind me, Satan.
Keep going.
You are an offense to
an
me.
Offense. Scandalon. Scandal. This is a stumbling stone. Stumbling stone. He goes from being the rock, the stone. Not the foundation stone, that's Yeshua, but the rock that he's going to build on. You got foundation stone and Peter, and then go.
Talk about a high low.
And now instead of that, he's saying, no, not you, you're a stumbling stone. You see the irony coming up here? Mm-hmm. What's Peter's first deal? He gets divine revelation. And then what's his response? Compassion. What kind of compassion? Human compassion. And Yeshua is receiving it how? Got the deep background? Another satanic attack. Look at that. Coming right out of my friend here. The guy I'm building the church on. This is great.
And it's the gates of Hades.
I just said Hades won't prevail.
What?
They're shooting at me immediately.
Yep.
The gates of Hades won't prevail. Oh, Lord, this can't happen to you. Shut up and sit out. All right. An offense to me you are. Because, keep going, verse 23.
For you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men.
Yeah, not mindful. Thronis, have in mind. You don't have in mind, ta tu theou, the things of God.
You're not spiritual.
Elataton anthropon, but those of man, the things of man. What you got in mind are the things of man and not
of
the
God.
Things of God.
Right.
I already told you, clam head. I got to suffer. You don't like it. Tough. Got to happen. And guess what? I'm going to build a church on you by suffering and dying. That's how I'm going to do it. And if you don't like that, you're in the wrong plan.
Heavy duty concept.
So the Jews are looking to coronate the king. The king says, I got to suffer and die and rise from the dead. We're saying, no, that shouldn't happen. He's saying, Satan, shut up. And we're standing around there after divine revelation, speaking Satan the next moment, and we're the bastion of the gates of Hades against the Lord, personified in Peter.
Yeshua,
the rock himself, Petros.
Yeshua did not explain the principles and concepts behind what he's about to do to his disciples.
I have a question for you. When we're saying you're Petros, and on this Petros I will
build... On this Petra, I will build.
Yes. I'm sorry, Petra. I will build Ecclesia.
Right, Ecclesia.
Could it, instead of it referring to the church, could it refer to the temple?
Well, it doesn't say temple, it says Ecclesia.
But I mean, it's
you can argue that that's...
I mean, we're a temple of living stones.
Right.
Right.
So, would the...
Yeah, when they ask him, what are you going to do with the temple? He says, you knock it down, I'll raise it up in 3 days. Mm-hmm. And they thought he's talking about the real temple. And he was talking about
his body.
3 days, temple of his
right.
body.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, that's in there. We're dealing with building, covering, and we're dealing with God being the covering, and we're in his house. And we're dealing with the idea that he came to make a living house out of us because he's building a house of prayer. Building a house of prayer.
So actually,
of all nations, you know.
So actually, instead of this being a very Catholic moment, it's actually a very Jewish moment.
Oh, absolutely. There you have it. So Satan and Peter offer Yeshua a kingdom without suffering. And Yeshua flips each time. With Satan, he turns over the word of God. And with Peter, he tells him, shut up and sit down. You know? Suffering Messiah was not understood by Peter. He, and as a result, he becomes not the rock, but the stumbling black.
Mm-hmm.
Now, guess what, Peter? Guess what? The foundation stone is going to become
stumbling block.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, it already started. You understand?
Mm-hmm.
It just showed up. And who? Peter, of all people. And he's going to play it out. He's going up to Jerusalem. He says, I got to go suffer and die there. Remember I said three times? He says, I'm going to go up to Jerusalem, suffer and die. And then Peter's going to deny him three times. He says, you're going to deny me three times? On the road, each time he says, I'm going to suffer and die. Remember I said these guys don't have a clue every time he says it? Well, we're looking real close at this one, and look what's happening here. I'm on the road to Jerusalem where I'm going to suffer and die. It's like, no, you can't have that happen. Get behind me, Satan. He still doesn't get it. He's going to suffer and die. He still doesn't get it now. He doesn't get it. And when Yeshua suffers and dies, I'm going to suffer and die. And when they're going to try and put me on a cross, you're going to deny me three times before the cock crows. And he goes, not me. I'll die right away. I'm in a hurry to die. I'm Peter. Yeah, three times before the cock crows, you'll die. Cuckoo, cuckoo. And Peter got him in just in time, Then he looks at him, in the movie. It's killing. So it's not understood by Peter. He becomes a stumbling block to Yeshua. He gets reproved and corrected after he tries to reprove and correct Yeshua. And that was inside the party with a well-meaning guy who's having this naturally compassionate human response to try to comfort somebody when they're giving you this horrible news. Well, I'm telling you, that dynamic's still out there. Nothing's changed yet. The new covenant hasn't gotten to this place where the Torah is so much in our hearts that you're a walking encyclopedia and you don't need to come to the Bible study or something. It hasn't happened yet. I'm out of business in that day. I can't wait. It's my retirement pension. Unless they knock me off first. I mean, they got a good chance. So what am I going to do? It's tough out there, Marcel. Mm. So after the resurrection, it's a stumbling block to the other Jews, right? 1 Corinthians 1:23. So look that one up. Guy's saying, we preach Messiah crucified, a scandal unto the Jews, and moron to the Greeks. You moron. A scandal to the Jews and moron to the Gentiles. Why? Because Gentiles are into wisdom. And this is moronic to those guys. And to the Jews, it's a scandal. Stand alone. A stumbling block. So somebody read 1 Corinthians 1:23.
we go on proclaiming a Messiah executed on a stake as a criminal. To Jew, this is an obstacle, and to Greek, it is nonsense.
So there it is again. And the word is, again, the same as what Peter was up against with Yeshua. He goes from being a Petra to a scandalon. Goes from being the rock of the church to the scandal of a stumbling block. And as Israel stumbled, so as to fall, they tripped over the stumbling stone. See, we're dealing with this. Jerusalem will lay in a corner, its cornerstone on the way to building the temple. And everybody that, what? Doesn't believe are going to trip over it. All right, so Peter gets divine revelation, then comes the switch, and he doesn't get a clue until post-resurrection. That's the first time his understanding starts to catch up with the moment. Now, I would submit to you that while we're waiting for the new covenant to come in, and while we're walking around, secure as all get out in God's will, we're threatened all the time by not being able to eat, we're threatened by getting embarrassed and marginalized by the society, we're threatened by people that are going to just write us off and dump us someplace. We're threatened by injury to our reputation. We're threatened by a billion things all the time. It hasn't really changed too much. They had more heat on them than we do on us right now. And guess what? They're writing a letter to those guys because they needed it. And we're still...
We need it.
There you go. We need it. So, there's a rabbinic principle here. And the principle is, a new act of God supersedes the old. A new act of God supersedes the old. So let's look at that. Hebrews 4, verse 8. Somebody else get Hebrews 7. I'll ask for verse 11 and verse 28. And one other person get Hebrews 10, and then we'll be ready to conclude.
Hebrews 4, 8.
Yep.
This new place of rest he is talking about does not mean the land of Israel that Joshua led them into. If that were what God meant, he would not have spoken long afterwards about today being the time to get in.
See, because Israel's told, go into the promised land. It's over there. Knock off the Canaanites and build heaven on earth. So we get in there, we partly knock off the Canaanites. It's tough out there. We don't live according to perfect faith. And the next thing you know, it's not heaven on earth. Then it's a tough place to live. Then you can't rest because it's a tough place to live. Then the guy comes and says, Joshua didn't do it. Well, he was set up perfectly, waited a generation. Moses passed the torch to Joshua. Everybody reinvented, got the covenant down. The guys had been spoon-fed from heaven. They were eating manna 6 days a week. They come out there on seventh day, lay around and grab the manna that they gathered on day six because they got two for the price of one. I mean, nobody had to work that hard for a living. Your clothes didn't wear out. I mean, it was wonderful. It was as close as you get to heaven on earth while a scorching wilderness. There's nobody could live out there. And then the generation grows up, watches these guys had a bad attitude, die. They all drop dead. Moses, I'm the last to go. He drops dead. And then Joshua says, okay, guys, it's time. The Lord's ready. Let's take the land. They go in there. They start knocking people off and walk around Jericho. The walls fall. I mean, it's heaven on earth. Rahab gets into the line. The walls fall in Jericho. Nobody's dying. They go to A. One guy grabs some silver. That's the beginning of the end. 36 righteous die in a war. If you're a righteous guy and they stick you with a spear and you're fighting a righteous war, nobody's ever died before. They got you with a spear. Marcel, how would you feel when the spear went and you look up at God and you say, I don't believe this. Nobody dies in a righteous war. I was following you. I did exactly what you said. I've done it perfectly. I'm clean. I'm ready for war. I give my half shekel. What's this spear doing to my stomach here? I can't believe what happened to me. Marcel, what's your feeling about that?
God says himself in his own word, he will show favor on those he wants to show favor, and he won't.
So here was you couldn't have it better. God says, holy war, go gird yourself for war, get ready. You got ready, you're perfect. You walk in there, some other guy grabs some silver, you eat it. So then later on they say, 36 righteous died over there. What are we going to do about this? And finally, since they're worrying about what happened to you, Marcel, they get that guy. So you didn't die in vain. Don't worry. You weren't secure in a righteous war where God told you to go do it. You got killed. Now, you understand what I'm getting at here? This was the perfect moment, except some guy grabbed some silver, and after that, goodbye. Experiment's going to take thousands of years, and it's going to happen in slow motion. All right?
A small group of people.
Because all we had to do was do it right, and we didn't, because Achan grabbed the silver, and you got killed over it. Next. See? Why did you? Who? You got to bury your brother's virgin. I didn't want to be a virgin. I know that guy gave it to me. You shouldn't take that soon. Why'd you stop him from taking it soon? I did. We stoned him. Well, he killed me first because he's a 362 if he killed me. Yeah, I know, Marcel. Get in line with the other martyrs. Everybody's going to be brought together at the end. You wait under the throne for a while. Give that guy a white sheet. We'll be back. Goodbye. Marcel goes, yeah, baby. And you're still down there screaming. I can't believe it. The time keeps ticking.
Thank you.
Yeah, I knew
putting that on me.
Hebrews 7, verse 11. Don't worry. You know, the next guy comes. We're still living and dying, remember? So 7:11.
If perfection could have been attained through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of it, the law was given to the people, why was there still a need for another priest to come, one in the order of Melchizedek, not in the order of Aaron?
See, when you're trying to build heaven on earth, you need to have some priest in there that doesn't drop dead. Every time they drop dead, you got to get somebody else in there. You got to train them. That guy might be a piker. You never know. He might be spoiled by his father. It's a big drag trying to keep on putting new guys in there. They outgrow their priestly costumes. Some guys are overweight. There's all kinds of problems associated with it. Well, you need one guy that can just, you know, hold the line forever and do it perfect. See?
True.
So that's 7-Eleven, you know, and that's why Melchizedek, he was sitting there in Jesuit Jerusalem, and the Jesuits were going, well, it was close to Jesuits, the Jebusites. I'm sorry.
Jesuits are Jebusites.
They're all holding on. Well,
we wouldn't catch that.
Right? Loyola University there.
Loyola. So the Jesuits.
He never died, so he must be still around somewhere.
He never died. He was never born. We don't have a genealogy on this guy. We don't know where he came from, where he went to.
Absolutely.
Somebody just dropped the records, right? He was a Jesuit. Oh, he was a Jebusite.
He's at Loyola.
This guy, you know, his parents forgot when he was born. You know, they didn't know what they were doing.
Okay. Pre-recorded history.
All right, that's 7-Eleven. So, and then he's in this order. Yeshua's in this order of a guy that never was, that never died, that never was born, and never... Okay. So we got this idea now where we don't have to keep killing all the priests all the time or let them drop dead, get a new guy and all that stuff. 7 verse 28.
For the law appoints the high priests men who are weak, but the oath which came after the law appointed the Son who has been made perfect forever.
Get it? Abraham, you know, first you had the promise, then you had the oath. Now you got the law appointing men, Torah appointing men, but the oath, here's the oath appointing a son, made perfect, having been perfected, is really the participle, past perfect. So having been perfected. So the oath appoints the Son having been perfected. That's what we're dealing with here. So, okay, that's great. We made it to the oath, and we made it to the real Son, and the archetypal Son, and before he was Abraham, he was before Abraham, and he was pre-existing, and then he's the real Son of God, he come in here, and the guy doesn't die after he, you know, is a high priest. Okay. And Melchizedek orders, so we don't have to worry about him dying. This is interesting. Okay. Hebrews 10, verse 2. So we're building the archetypal reality on earth.
Otherwise, wouldn't the offering of those sacrifices have ceased? For if the people performing the service had been cleansed once and for all, they would no longer have sins on their conscience.
Now, let me get this one straight. The conscience. So it's like, after our sins are covered, somehow we still got conscience problems? Is that the deal? We've got conscience problems out there.
Mm-hmm.
Hebrews 10, verse 2. And you do this atonement thing, and you're right with God, and you still got a conscience problem over what? Are you going to do it again? You did do it. Why you did it? You got forgiven anyway. You're still bugged about it. What's your problem? We don't have conscience problem anymore, right? We kill somebody, say we're sorry, and we're done. Oh, say you're sorry, and then cover yourself with the blood of the Lamb in Yeshua's name, and then you're done. No conscience problem, right? What happened? What is he talking about? What doesn't exist for the cleansed? What does not exist for the cleansed? Under which covenant? Let's hear 10:2 again. Jennifer, make a comment.
What?
Oh, go ahead.
You want me to read it?
Read 10 verse 2.
Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered because the worshippers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had conscience of sins? Consciousness.
So we're the same old guys, bringing the same old sacrifices over the same old sins, and it's the song that never ends. And every year we're back there with our sin offering. Every Yom Kippur we're back there going, forgive us for the sins of
this,
that. And we slandered you, you know, and we tried to cover it up and used your name and invoked your name to swear we never said it when we did it. And we, sorry, we did that again. You know, we don't do that anymore next year. Shalach lanu kaper lanu. And I left out machal lanu, which means please just drop the punishment part. Forgive us, but don't cut us some slack on the punishment. Machal us. Forgive having to punish us.
And then cover us.
And then, yeah, don't. Make us at one with you now. So first forgive us, and then get us out of the consequence of the penalty, and then atone for us. So we can move on here. Now look, the suffering servant and David, Messiah, and the Son of God, all conflated in the ministry of Yeshua. Satan comes and says, I'll give it to you without the suffering deal. He says, out. Peter comes and says, oh, this would be terrible if this has to happen to you. He says, out. Now the Hebrew guys are going through it, and they're getting hammered. And these guys are, they're writing a book to these guys saying, listen, guys, you can get into heaven. You got direct access. Newer, better way to get there with the Jews. You work out your salvation if you're trembling. Whether it's the way that will get you in or not is not known. Because when you come down to it, a judgment day, you don't know up or down on you. And Paul's out there saying, well, obviously, you know, if there isn't mercy, you're a dead man. And so you can't earn your way in. And the number of mitzvot you do, they add up, but they don't add up enough because you got the, on the other side, the gravity that's pulling you down, and the gravity that's pulling you down is infinite. So you got a bunch of stuff on the plus side of the register. You got infinite pulling you down. And, you know, what's going to happen when you're standing there before the king? And the guys that are pure justice, you know, they would be Noah all over again. It's the end for you. And they just kill everybody one at a time rather than kill the whole world. And God said with the covenant, no, I'm not going to do that anymore. And after that, there's a little more mercy going on. But how much mercy and what? You don't know. So that's why the Torah doesn't have any answers on that. There's no atonement for cold-blooded first-degree murder. And no one knows salvation with fear and trembling. First of all, Torah is not even directing itself toward living forever. But second of all, if you're dealing with the world to come, nobody knows how they're going to come out on that because it's up to God. And though they got away and they understand, there's no way to know how God's going to judge it because he's got to determine how much slack he's going to cut you. And he's got to cut you a lot, and it's out of your control. And you got no chance without the slack. And you don't know. You just don't know. So here the Messianics are being told, oh, we know, and we got a newer, better way, because we know. We know that if we're really sold out for Yeshua, it's all fine. And at the beginning, we started talking about the new way, and whether it's brand new or renewable, or what it's going to look like 2,000 years from now when the next guys get the next new way, or whether that's, you know.
Hopefully we won't have to wait that long.
Because in Hebrews, when you're trying to contrast the new covenant with the old covenant, that the old is passing away, I tried to point out that doesn't mean it's bad. It just means it was ineffective and weak and it wasn't going to get you there. And the new covenant, they're telling us it gets you there. So yeah, the assurance that through Messiah he's brokered your way in as long as, you know, you're tight with him. Meaning he's Lord, you're not fooling around. And God is Lord of your life, and you're not fooling around. Okay. So back to the end then. Suffering and the role of suffering. What can we conclude from this? I mean, Peter, of all people, one minute he's speaking the word of God, and the next minute he's speaking the word of Satan. Just back to back. Right in front. And over what issue? To suffer or not to suffer, that is the question. Well, certainly not you, Yeshua. And the rest of us, we can understand. But not you. And die. Well, we can understand we have to die. But not you. And after that, you're supposed to save us from suffering and from death. And Yeshua's answer is really what?
Don't try to tempt me again.
Yeah. Get behind me, Satan. Suffer and die. It's the only way, huh?
The disciples were still thinking the Jewish way.
The Messiah was the king, Jewish way.
The Messiah was supposed to come and be the king to take them out of all that.
And we're so much smarter now. What have we learned? But the Jewish way didn't work, and now we do it Messiah's way. And since he already died, we don't have to suffer, right? Isn't that what we learned?
No.
No, we didn't learn that.
That's not true.
What did we learn?
That's not true.
What did we learn from this?
We're still suffering.
We're still suffering.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, then what do we
learn? But we understand that the suffering improves us. Without suffering, we become complacent,
right.
and just like in the Hazin poem that we studied so hard and learned, we grow fat and kick and
take it for granted.
Right. Yeah.
So, what should be your motivation for living at this point? Avodah. What's that? Now, how's that not just mitzvot for, you know, running the temple service? Motivation. What's your motivation? I want to do Avodah so I can accumulate mitzvot in heaven so that I can be greatest in the kingdom of heaven so that God will be happy with me.
Well, one of the things you said is it's his story. You know, it's not us.
It's his story.
Not about us.
Right, it is his story. That's important.
Right.
See, we've got to be made over. You got to look at what the world system's telling you right now, what you do to conform. The Hebrews were being told, don't try to conform. Well, I got to fit in, don't I? Otherwise, I'm a queer. Actually, you don't know who fits in.
Well, it's going to get worse.
It's going to get worse. Do you believe that seeing God's visible presence would inspire you to live differently? Thomas the Doubter called the risen Yeshua, my Lord and my God. Yeshua answered him, have you trusted because you see me? How blessed are those who do not see, but trust anyway. That was at the end of John. You fool yourself if you think that seeing God will change your behaviors. You must prepare to see God first. How blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Matthew 5:8. So you've got to want to see God. Well, to want to see God, you've got to decide that you're putting yourself on a course to be pure in heart. If you're going to put yourself on a course to be pure in heart, what do you think that means for your personal agendas? What do you think that means for anything that does you any good at all? Anything that does you, as far as you're concerned, any good at all?
Suspect.
It's got to be suspect at the level of motivation, right? At the level of motivation, it has to be suspect. Live is evil spelled backwards. If you're going to live, be careful what you're living for. To prepare, spend time being transformed. Is your heart so pure that you act without an agenda? You must reserve the highest quality of time for abiding in the presence of God. Highest quality. You can live for abiding in the presence of God. To live for abiding. During that time, you will certainly be transformed, but your honest motivation must be
to seek God.
Solely to
glorify.
Please.
To abide and to glorify.
Solely to please God. Solely to glorify God in your life. Solely to please God. So wait a minute, I wouldn't have a life that way. Exactly. Well, if I won't have a life, I mean, there won't be anything left of me. Exactly. Yeah, but you're talking about annihilation. I'm going to be like, gone. Exactly. How do you think you're going to get into the archetypal idea up there? You know, of course you're going to be gone.
That's dying for yourself.
That's
right?
Dying, yes, exactly. It's dying. The rest will take care of itself. You will change. Your taste will change. The things that will bring joy to your heart will change. Your greatest delight will bring joy to
the Father.
The Father. That's what your greatest delight will be. I mean, like, you might get carried away and, like, miss dinner once in a while. Your favorite TV program might sneak by one week. Your greatest hobby, you might get sidetracked and miss out. You could leave your wallet someplace because, you know, you got carried away. I mean, you could, like, really be irresponsible to the effect that you'd lose something that's valuable to you or lose track of it, something. That this could happen once in a while. I'm not saying always. I'm saying once in a while. Why? Because you got sidetracked. What did you get sidetracked doing?
Glorifying the Father.
Yeah, annihilating yourself. Glorifying the Father. And when you annihilated yourself, you left your wallet somewhere, or so on. You know, instead of that last moment when you grabbed for the wallet, you were like, dead, you know? And, you know, your wallet will take care of itself. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be handed. Nothing will delight you more because your taste will have changed. And then transformed, you'll be granted the desires of your heart. You see, you got to be transformed to even know the desires of your heart. Look what happened to Peter. Oh, you shouldn't suffer. It's a good line, Peter. I'm a human being too. And if we can get out of it, I mean, even Yeshua wanted to get out of it. Satan tried. He tried through Peter. And he'll try to get you too. Maybe even through, you know, your close friends. Happened to him, he's going to build his ecclesia on it. Because in the end, you're dealing with a dynamic. And the dynamic is associated with your motivation, what makes you tick. And the dynamic is what has to change. And the only way that really is going to change is you sit down and say, you know, I get it. God is like really, he knows so much about me that I really don't have a chance. I don't have a chance. So I might as well just, you know, quit trying to, you know, cut myself a little slack here and there because I need it. It's like, there's something I need more than that. And what is it? To get real about the fact that I'm owned and that I don't have a life.
No, that's a hard one. It's a hard one for especially Americans. We've got a golden goose. You can't take that away from us, that golden goose, man. The lay those nice eggs, boy. Cash them in and we can get all kinds of goodies and, you know.
If you turned around and gave away all your money to the poor, I bet the next day you'd be trying to get some.
No, they'd be putting me in a straitjacket.
See, I'm not telling you to do that, because I'm saying God will prepare you to be able to do with your whole being what you need to do. If he wants all your money, there's a million ways he can take it from you.
Yeah.
He can take your health. He can export you overseas. He can get you lost in a mountain range 20 miles away from here. There's a million ways he can take away all your wealth for as little or as long as he wants. And when you go out and try and do it to break your agenda, that again is you being desperate to try to... That's not the way you get to it. The way you get to it is you're in his presence. And the way you get to it is you listen. And the way you get to it is you got your eyes on him. And the way you get to it is you naturally go to him first over anything dramatic that occurs in your life. That's that inner circle idea that I talk about a lot.
Yeah, I understand.
That he's on your inner circle.
I understood that principle when my brother had his first child, and my mother was watching my niece, and she couldn't find her security blanket, and she was having a conniption fit. And I thought, you know, what's wrong with this picture? You know, so I think we haven't grown away from that. We still are, you know, looking for those security things.
Right. When your tabernacle, when your tabernacle is perfectly built, you will be flooded with the glory of the presence of God. If it happened to Judaism, when we collectively were pulled out of Pharaoh's big house, that's at the beginning of Exodus, and then walked over to Sinai and followed instructions perfectly to build the house so that God could dwell in his house in our midst. That's the reason Exodus is two parts. You build not a big house, and now you build God's house, and you're a slave on sanctuary property. And when you do it perfectly, he floods his house with his presence. Yeshua comes and he says, I came to tabernacle among you. And now he's building the house again. Of all nations, yes, there's a corporate sign. And of you, there's an individual sign. And when you're pure in heart, which you can't do, you need to be transformed. But when you are, then you'll get the desires of your heart. And you'll find out what they are when you change your tastes and decide, I'm really going to find out the glory of the desires of my heart when I decide that my first taste and my first motivation should be sown to please God first in all things in my life.
Well, see, that's radical, Jeff. When you say that word, to give up ourselves, that's a fear that most people have. Yeah. That you know, once I come to accept God on his terms, I lose myself. I don't want to lose myself.
Absolutely.
I don't want to, you know, I'm comfortable with who I am. I've come to know my identity and be comfortable with all my gifts and strengths and talents and, you know, and everybody is proud of me and looks up to me. And, you know, I don't want to lose that all in a moment's notice by turning my life over to God and then becoming conformed to his image. I want to be on the same level with him. I want my image and he can have his.
Yeah.
But I love him and he'll, you know, and I'll serve him, but I want that same level.
That's right.
See, this is what I hear from people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, you know, they don't like it because God's a power freak, right?
Yeah.
He wants to control everything, right?
Yeah, he doesn't want second place.
Except we're power freaks, right?
Yeah, we are.
That's why we like to keep him at a distance, right?
Oh. Well, that's why that image of the caterpillar turning into the butterfly is so important, because we're running around here being really great caterpillars. We don't even realize, you know, the dimensions out there that are there for us, you know, in God's perfect plan for us. But we have to get into the cocoon, or the seed has to go into the ground in order to grow up and bear fruit.
And that going into the cocoon requires release, total, complete release, which is a fearful thing. It's
right.
The story of the guy hanging from the cliff, clouds below him, and he hears a voice, let go. Let go.
Yep.
Did I really, really hear you?
Yes.
Is there anybody else up there?
A second opinion.
I like that second opinion. Do I?
A second opinion, yeah. Well, you get it.
Yeah.
I don't know what to say beyond that to motivate you. You know, I mean, it really comes down to getting honest with what reality is anyway. That's what it is to me. To me, the more terrifying side is that at the end I'm going to be found out. And it's going to be all laid open. So then I sit down and say, well, if they're going to peel me anyway, good grief, get the darkness out now. Because it's going to come out anyway. So that's what motivates me. Just saying, I'm going to get peeled. I know it. I know I'm going to get peeled.
Well, here's the dilemma. In order for me to arrive at that place, I have to be removed from my comfort zone, as you shared
right.
many times. So... if there's no one praying for me that God will do that in my life, and then I can't do it because I'm too weak spiritually, then I'm in a bad place. And I'm going to fall through the cracks unless I can get to a place where I can build up enough courage to say, okay, God, I'm willing to take a step now. If not, then I'm hoping there's somebody praying for me that God then will have mercy and just intervene and remove me from my comfort zone. And I think that it's easier for the person who develops a love relationship with the Lord that then they can they're willing to go that next level, plateau, to reach up for it, get on top and see what's there.
Probably got a minion here, so let's pray for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Praise you, God. Thanks that you do have a perfect plan. And we've seen enough of it to be encouraged by it. Thanks that you give us examples like Peter, who knew the perfect plan, and yet you reveal every step of the way where he was caught behind the curve. And yet you built your church on him, the Ecclesia. And he really is venerated as St. Peter. And it was the start of something permanent. Praise you, God.
Us to decrease that you might increase, and when we're too afraid to release ourselves to this destiny, help us to be reminded that perfect love casts out all fear, and we don't have anything to fear if we turn our hearts and our souls over to you exclusively. Help us to be pure in heart. We might see you, that you might be glorified within us. Please turn each of our bodies into your holy temple. Fill us even as you filled the tabernacle with your glory.
Blessed are the pure in heart, they shall see God. Prepare us, Lord, for our days ahead. Help us to see that when we choose to glorify you, you choose to surround us with your glory and to fill our lives with light. here tonight. May our taste so change that our love for darkness becomes a thing of the past. In Yeshua's name. Amen. To the kitchen for Kiddush.